From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi met Tuesday. Among the topics discussed, disagreements over the South China Sea and the DPRK. CCTV's Wadrin reports.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm delighted to welcome Minister Wang Yi.
Wang Yi stood shoulder to shoulder with John Kerry, pledging his desire to work together.
Both sides know China and the U.S. have far more common interests than areas of disagreement, and we work together on so many areas that far outweigh areas of friction.
But as they expanded to the contentious South China Sea issue, Kerry said a diplomatic solution is very important, and he wants to bring together all concerned parties for negotiations.
We believe that it is important for a diplomatic solution, for a solution to occur which follows the rule of law, that brings the countries to the table for negotiated resolution, not for unilateral actions.
Wang said that China has historically owned those islands in the South China Sea and also wants peace and stability and free navigation in the region. But he said China does not want to see any more close-up military reconnaissance or the dispatch of missile destroyers or strategic bombers there. He also pointed out that Beijing has always been willing to resolve the issue peacefully. But, he said, one particular country, which he explicitly named, has been reluctant to take part in the dialogue.
It is exactly one country, and let me not avoid mentioning the name, that is the Philippines, has violated the stipulation of Article 4 of the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the South China Sea, and has given up on dialogue and negotiations with the direct concerned parties of China, which is regrettable and which is ill-advised. And of course, we will not stop implementing the DOC because of one country's violation.
Also at the press conference, Wang mentioned a recent report in the Wall Street Journal, which inferred that China has been building radar facilities on some of the islands in the South China Sea. But the foreign minister said focus should not be solely on China, but military buildups by some other countries in the region.
I hope the media will not only see the radar, but more importantly perhaps, that every day the advanced armaments and equipment emerging in the South China Sea, including the missile bombers, the strategic destroyers, why people have chosen to ignore them.
Wang stressed that in recent decades some countries have illegally occupied China's islands and reefs and militarized them, not only with radars, but other kinds of artillery. Wadrin, CCTV.
Tuesday also saw another U.S. claim that China was installing military equipment on the South China Sea islands that have been at the center of the dispute between Beijing and Washington. CNN reported that China had deployed fighter jets to a disputed island in the South China Sea. That according to a U.S. official who Tuesday said it's not the first time. U.S. officials say China has placed J-11 and J-7 fighter jets on Woody Island, part of the Paracel Island chain, after expanding the runway there in 2014. China controls the Paracel chain, but Taiwan and Vietnam also have claims to it, while Brunei, Malaysia, and the Philippines are also embroiled in disputes with China and each other over regional islands and their surrounding waters. Documents recently released appear to show that Turkish officials on the border with Syria frequently communicated and worked with Daesh fighters. Among the most damning of the released documents are transcripts, which reportedly detail several phone conversations between unnamed Turkish officers and Mustafa Demir, a key Daesh operative in the border region. The transcripts are reportedly part of an ongoing investigation into several individuals and their ties to the terrorist group. They detail phone conversations and also appear to indicate that Turkish officers met with Demir in the border region. Demir is said to be linked to Ilhami Bali, the 33-year-old Daesh leader, suspected of ordering the deadliest terror attack in Ankara's history. The twin bombings last October left 102 people dead and more than 400 injured. One of the transcripts, translated into English, dates back to November 25, 2014. Demir reportedly asked an unnamed officer to arrange a meeting with a commander, and in another conversation, a Turkish officer asked Demir to meet him and his comrades at a minefield. Access to unlimited supplies and recruits delivered to the Syrian battlefield through Turkey is largely seen as the key source of Daesh's resilience and longevity. Ankara's failure to secure the 60-mile border region has raised questions about Turkey's intentions regarding the deadly Syrian conflict. This month marks the 50th anniversary of the overthrow of the government of Ghana and its leader, Kwame Nkrumah. Nkrumah was one of a group of anti-colonial African leaders to come to power in the 1950s and 60s. His overthrow became a template that still has deep relevance today. Thus says Abiyomi Ezekwe, the publisher of the Pan-African Newswire, in a recent article at workers.org. We spoke with him via Skype Tuesday. I'm looking at your article. I'm looking at workers.org. Nkrumah, 50 years since the CIA-led coup. Why don't you give our listeners a little history?
Well, Kwame Nkrumah was one of the great leaders to emerge during the period of the third decade of the 20th century. He was a African born in the formerly known country as the Gold Coast, which was a British colony up until 1957. He studied in the United States at Lincoln University beginning in 1935. He also attended the University of Pennsylvania. He was heavily influenced by many African Americans, namely W.E.B. Du Bois. He was a member of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, a Garvey organization, when he was living in Pennsylvania at Lincoln, right outside of Philadelphia. He was also influenced by the likes of Marx, Engels, as well as other Western philosophers and scholars. And by 1945, he had completed 10 years of study here in the United States, where he had obtained both undergraduate as well as graduate degrees. During the course of his study here, he did not have a lot of money, so therefore he had to work to supplement his income. So he got a clear insight into racism, into the labor market inside the United States. And then he also developed ideas around anti-imperialism and the African personality, cultural views on the role of the African mind, the African personality in the overall liberation struggle. As early as 1941, we have discovered writings by Nkrumah, theoretical writings, from the University of Pennsylvania's Education Journal, where he talked about the role of African culture. However, in 1943, during the period of World War II, we find his essay on imperialism and the role of Africans and the struggle against imperialism. This is a very, very significant theme because when he leaves the United States in 1945 and goes to England, he is introduced by C.L.R. James, who was residing in the United States at the time, to George Padmore, a Trinidadian activist, same as C.L.R. James, which had ties with the left. And George Padmore, Kwame Nkrumah, and W.E.B. Du Bois were the key leaders in the 5th Pan-African Congress, which was convened in October of 1945 in Manchester, England. And that conference proved to be a turning point in the overall struggle for national liberation and African unity. The conference brought together a number of students, trade unionists, farmers, who, in fact, were making a difference in the overall struggle against colonialism and racism. And the program that was drafted at the 5th Pan-African Congress in October of 1945 led, in many cases, to mass demonstrations, to general strikes, to upheavals within the colonial states throughout the African continent, as well as the escalation of the struggle against racism and domestic colonialism in the United States. So Nkrumah intersected with the African-American struggle, the struggle of those from the Caribbean, as well as being influenced by socialist thinking and ideology, and at the same time being heavily rooted in the conditions of the Gold Coast, of Africa, knowing that Africa had to be independent, it had to be united, and also had to move towards socialist reconstruction.
He also was an acquaintance or better of Paul Robeson's, right?
Yes, and Paul Robeson was one of the leaders of the Council on African Affairs, the CAA, which was an organization that did a lot of pioneering work in support of the struggle against colonialism in Africa. Also associated with the CAA was Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, who also had a tremendous impact on Nkrumah, as well as William Alpheus Hutton, who was another scholar and activist who played a very important role in the Council on African Affairs as its executive secretary. Hutton was a graduate of New York University. He had taught some years at Howard University, however, eventually become a full-time activist. The work that was done by these individuals later landed them in tremendous difficulty, particularly during the Cold War after 1947. As we know, Robeson, Du Bois, as well as Hutton, all were forced to come before the United States Congress, before the U.S. government. Their passports were confiscated. Du Bois was threatened with prosecution and imprisonment. He was able to defeat those attempts. But Hutton was, of course, sentenced to a time of in prison inside the United States for refusing to turn over the financial and membership records of the Council on African Affairs and register the organization as an agent of a foreign power, which it was not. The stakes were very high during this time period in the United States, and they became very high for Kwame Nkrumah when he eventually went back to the Gold Coast at the end of 1947. He was brought there by a group called the United Gold Coast Convention, which was an organization mainly of chiefs and lawyers and business people who were not necessarily harboring the same type of politics, left-wing oriented politics that Nkrumah had. They had learned of his activities in the United States and in Britain and wanted to utilize his organizing skills to build a base for their constituencies in the Gold Coast. Nkrumah in 1948 was thrown into prison with other members of the UGCC, saying that they had organized a series of rebellions. Actually, they were really putting forward a program. The servicemen's march, which resulted in the massacre of ex-service people who had been enlisted in the British forces during World War II, were just demanding adequate treatment in terms of veterans' benefits. And apparently this was such a threat to the British authorities that they killed a number of these protesters. This prompted a general strike and a series of rebellions across the Gold Coast, landing Nkrumah and other members of the UGCC in prison. And they were released eventually, but Nkrumah went directly to the youth. He formed a group called the Committee on Youth Organizations. He went to the rural areas, to the villages. He organized women as a major source of his political base. And he also organized a newspaper, the Evening News, the Accra Evening News, in 1948. A lot of his activities were opposed by the United Gold Coast Convention leadership. And by early 1949, the relations between the UGCC and Nkrumah and his youth organizers and others became very strained. So by June of 1949, a lot of the people who were around Nkrumah at the time within the Committee on Youth Organization said that they should break away and form their own political party, particularly when the UGCC took action to try to demote Nkrumah and to minimize his influence. So they opened up a new front of struggle on June 12th of 1949. They held the first rally of the Convention People's Party, which drew over 60,000 people in Accra. So this, of course, put him on a rapid trajectory towards winning mass support inside the country. In 1950, they embarked upon what was known as a positive action campaign. They were demanding self-government now, whereas the UGCC's demand was self-government in the shortest possible time. This general strike in 1950 landed Nkrumah again in prison, where he spent an entire year there. And of course, by the time he had gotten out of prison 1 year later, some of his comrades, such as Komla Badema and others, continued to organize among the people. And they were so effective that they participated in a local election in 1951 that was part of a reform program that had been instituted by the British in the aftermath of the rebellions of 1948. And the Convention People's Party won the majority of the seats in this new, more or less localized form of indirect legislative rule in the Gold Coast. So Nkrumah was immediately released from prison in 1951, and he was appointed, along with his party, as the leader of government business. They joined a coalition with the British colonialists as a means of transitioning from colonialism to independence. That process took approximately 6 years. He was later elected again in 1953 in a national election. In 54, he was designated as prime minister. Then another election in 1956 around the issue of full independence was won also by the CPP. And in 1957, on March the 6th, Ghana became an independent state.
And then the period of independence, your article shows that there were folks from the United States that took up residence in Ghana, including some notables.
Yeah, several hundred African-Americans went to Ghana to live. And some of the notables were people like Julian Mayfield, the novelist and political organizer, who in the 1950s had published a series of articles. He also worked very closely with Robert and Mabel Williams, Mae Mallory. And as a result, when the federal government came down strongly on Robert Williams, Mabel Williams, and Mae Mallory, Julian Mayfield left the United States. He eventually wound up in Ghana under Nkrumah. And since he was a prolific writer, a well-known published author, he wound up serving in various aspects of Nkrumah's domestic and foreign policy. Eventually, he was placed as the editor of the African Review, which was a journal dealing with Pan-Africanism. There were many others, Maya Angelou, for example, who passed away several years ago, was also working in Ghana as well as a teacher. She was also a dancer and an actor by the time she went there. Alice Windham, another leading African-American woman, social worker, played an instrumental role as well in Ghana during the time. There was also Vicky Garvin, who was a left-wing activist, had ties with the Communist Party, and had lived in Ghana for many, many years as well. W.B. Du Bois went there in 1960 with Shirley Graham Du Bois, who was his second wife. Shirley Graham Du Bois was a writer, an organizer, a public figure in her own right. She had been for years a member of the NAACP up until the period of the Cold War. Her father was a AME minister. And Shirley Graham Du Bois had been also been a longtime member of the Communist Party in the United States. She was instrumental in introducing Du Bois to a lot of figures on the left inside the United States as well as internationally. In 1960, they took up residence in the United States because their passports had been seized in 1950, and they were not able to get their passports back until 1958. That was true also of Paul Robeson as well. And after 1958, they embarked upon a world tour, which took them to the Soviet Union, to China, to various countries in Europe, Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe, as well as going to Ghana. And when they went to Ghana, Nkrumah asked them to take up residence there. They were given citizenship, Ghanaian citizenship. Du Bois was appointed as the director of the Encyclopedia Africana Project, which was designed to write and publish an encyclopedia of the history of Africa. Shirley Graham Du Bois eventually became the first director of Ghana National Television. So they occupied a very prominent roles within Ghana society under the CPP government. However, Nkrumah's objectives, political objectives, of full, genuine political as well as economic independence, his strong emphasis on African unity for the formation of the United States of Africa, and also his anti-imperialism and his reliance on socialist thought analysis, and to eventually bring socialism to all of Africa. This is what put him particularly at loggerheads with the United States, with Britain, who worked very, very incessantly, particularly after 1961, to bring about his removal from office. There was, of course, the general strike of 1961, which was utilized as a political counterweight to Nkrumah. It split the CPP government. Then in 62, there was an assassination attempt on Nkrumah in the north of Ghana, where several people were killed. And between August of 1962 and January of 1964, there was a whole reign of terror leveled against the Ghana government, against the CPP, and its supporters inside Ghana, resulting in the deaths of over 300 people. In 1963, there was a bombing of the rally held in commemoration of the anniversary, the 13th anniversary of Positive Action campaign of 1950, that killed numerous people. Also, there was another assassination attempt against Nkrumah in January of 1964, where a person within the police and the security forces attempted to assassinate him. And they, as a result of the activities of one loyal military guard who was killed in this assassination attempt, and Nkrumah survived. These are some of the elements that he was facing leading up to the critical period of 1965 and 1966, where the United States openly began to challenge his overall political views. In 1965, Nkrumah published a book entitled Neocolonialism: The Last Stage of Imperialism. And in this book, he identifies the United States as being the principal impediment to African independence, genuine African independence, to Pan-Africanism. And the book had such an impact that the former United States Undersecretary of State for African Affairs, a man named G. Menon Williams, who was from the state of Michigan, who had been governor of the state in the 50s and later had been appointed by John F. Kennedy as his Undersecretary for African Affairs, and who stayed over after Kennedy's assassination in the Johnson administration, actually wrote a letter of protest to the Ghana ambassador in Washington, D.C., objecting to the assertions made by Dr. Kwame Nkrumah in his book on neocolonialism. And of course, it came out at the time, there was much suspicion that the Central Intelligence Agency was involved and created the conditions for the coup. In later years, particularly during the 1970s.
Stockwell, yeah.
Yeah, Stockwell's book, as well as the declassification of State Department documents as well, goes into specific details about how even the U.S. Embassy in Accra was utilized as a staging ground for the coup. You know, the making of signs, the recruitment of the key players involved in the coup d'etat. The coup was actually carried out on the ground by lower-ranking military officers. Many of the generals refused to go along with this effort to overthrow the government. One leading figure, Major General Barwa, was actually assassinated by the coup makers because he objected to what they were attempting to do. But the police the Ghanaian police under the commander J.W.K. Harley really played the most instrumental role in the coup, because they were able to go around and arrest the key leaders of the Convention People's Party, other leaders of the military apparatus. They were the ones who, in fact, really engineered the entire process leading to the coup. And Nkrumah was out of the country when the seizure of power took place. He was en route to Vietnam, interestingly enough, in an effort, an international effort, to negotiate a peace settlement between the United States and Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson, being the president at the time of the coup, and Nkrumah had written to Johnson prior to his trip to Vietnam, letting him know he was going there. And Johnson apparently had let him know that they would not try to interfere in his trip. But, of course, they had ulterior plans to get him out of the country. So these low-ranking military officers and police were able to seize power. Other personalities that were involved in the process, the ambassador in Ghana at that time was an African-American named Franklin Williams. He had attended Lincoln University with Nkrumah back during the period when Nkrumah was here in the 30s and 40s. And many people have suspected that his appointment was clearly connected with the coup. And Nkrumah mentions his name in a book that was written after the coup entitled Dark Days in Ghana, saying that Williams, from what his sources had told him from inside the country, because he had taken up residence in Guinea, in West Africa, a former French colony that was headed at the time by Ahmed Sekou-Touré. He was made co-president there and given a residence in Guinea. But in the book Dark Days in Ghana, and Nkrumah mentions Franklin Williams as a person that played a significant role in the coup. Now, Williams was made aware of this assertion, and he actually wrote a letter to one of Nkrumah's friends saying, please tell the Osagyefo, which was what they called Nkrumah affectionately in Ghana, the Redeemer, that Williams said personally he had no role in the coup. Well, of course, documents have been released by the U.S. State Department since that time that suggest otherwise. But it was a concerted campaign to derail the African Revolution, to prevent genuine independence and socialism from taking root in Africa. It had a tremendous impact in Ghana. It had a tremendous impact in other parts of Africa. But the African Revolution continued. One issue that Nkrumah was working on at the time of the coup was the white settler rebellion in Rhodesia. And he had broken diplomatic relations with Britain over the question of Rhodesia, and had suggested that African military forces be sent there to confront the rebellion led by Ian Smith, who by 1980 was out of office due to escalating armed struggle, as well as the realization by the international community that they had to move towards majority rule in what is now known as Zimbabwe. So these are some of the issues that Nkrumah addressed during his tenure in office. But as I mentioned before, Ghana today, in many ways, has never been able to overcome its falling victim to this coup d'etat for the last five decades.
And, you know, the modality that they used with the coup is like an embryonic version of AFRICOM. They were able to mobilize a command and control structure among the lower-level officers external to the command structure in their military. And now there's just an integration at the top level.
Most definitely. And this is what Nkrumah had warned. In 1963, he published a book entitled Africa Must Unite. It was published in conjunction with the founding of the Organization of African Unity in 1963. And in that book, he makes a case for the formation of the United States of Africa and an all-African military command. And he says in the book that the United States or any other Western powers should have no military bases on the continent. So these are, as you mentioned, precursors that took place in the early and mid-1960s to what we see unfolding today on the African continent.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.